This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
From Joy 94.9 Community Radio, this is the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera. In this Joycast, you'll get to hear an exclusive extended version of the weekly feature interview.
The Fool and the Opera with Dan Vo.
Brian Castle Onions is a well-known conductor, as well-known for his great artistry as for his acid wit. He's worked with opera companies across the globe, and his intimate knowledge of what happens behind the scenes has led to an excellent book called Losing the Plot in Opera. Brian, thanks for joining me.
Hi, I'm pleased you said it was an excellent book.
I did read it.
It was very good. The words aren't too big, so you know, most people can read it.
Now, emotional sopranos, bitchy tenors, incompetent choruses, and rebellious orchestras. It sounds like you've seen it all.
Yeah, look, actually, the publisher gave them those sort of titles, the bitchy and rebellious and things, incompetent choruses. I thought I'd have a bad reaction with the chorus next time I saw them, but they just coped with it, you know, because we bitch about each other in the green room, so that's fine.
What sort of inspired this book?
Well, look, I have a million stories because I've been working in the industry longer than I would care to remember, and all those old singers have fabulous anecdotes that happened to them. And look, I was always interested in hearing those stories about, you know, those, you know, the stupid things that used to happen in old productions that, you know, everyone knows about. And I've seen so much happening that is so funny. And because opera is sort of a serious art form, but if you rehearse it seriously, you're going to suicide. So look, I take the piss out of everything, as everyone who works with me knows. You know, I treat everyone on the same level. Like I'm super rude to Kerry Takanawa, as I am to, you know, someone who sells a program or sweeps the stage. But you know, if you treat everyone on the same level, well, then they respect you. You know, because the lowly, as you might think, are still on that same level as, you know, the superstar. I have millions of anecdotes and a long history of working in the medium, and I was doing a big outdoor concert a couple of years ago where I conduct as well as compare. You know, I introduce each item in a funny way. I hate going to concerts where they say, and this is where the soprano sings about her boyfriend or something. You know, that's just boring. So I tell a bit of gossip about, you know, what's happened in the rehearsal, or what the soprano just said to me in her dressing room, or how much her jewellery is costing, you know, the $3 million or 49 cents. And audiences love that sort of thing. And at one of those concerts, a sort of talent scout from a publishing company was there, and a couple of days later they contacted me and asked if I'd be interested in writing a book, which I was, you know, so flattered, you know, someone thought I could actually put two words together. Anyway, so look, a couple of years later, the baby was born, and here we are, Losing the Plot in Opera.
So have you had any negative repercussions to it?
None whatsoever.
Oh, right, okay.
Look, I lie. Only one, because look, I tell, you know, sort of quite intimate details about people, but sometimes I don't say who they are. And I did get a message from someone to say they were, you know, threatening a lawsuit because, you know, I had sort of defamed their career. And I had to contact them back and, you know, through the lawyer and say, look, I'm terribly sorry, but it wasn't you, darling. You know? And so this woman, Miss Mezzo, would have had to have proven that she didn't wear underwear, you know, on stage while singing Carmen and spoke filthy language in English whilst, you know, singing an opera in French and being unreliable and, you know, and not being in the right place where the director had put her. You know, and this woman thought I was talking about her. I should have.
That would have been quite scandalous. You should let her go through with it. Now, let's talk about some of the definitions that are in the book because, you know, as for beginners, that most of the people listening at the moment
are all beginners.
Yes. Oh, okay. Well, that's very nice. To think that way.
But it's true.
Yeah.
You know, once you think you know everything, your career's stopped, you'll never stop learning anything. That's it. That's in life, isn't it? It's getting a bit profound now.
Yeah. Would you like to continue on your
own? No, I wouldn't.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, there's one thing that I always have a bit of difficulty getting into this whole thing, which is this notion of bel canto. What exactly is bel canto?
Bel canto, an absolute translation of that is beautiful singing. Mm. But The bel canto style is a different thing. For me, I think the peak of vocal writing was in that period, like from about 1810 to 1850 or something, where the composers, the three top Italian composers, Bellini, Donizetti and Rossini, they knew how to write for voices. And in those days, they were the great superstars, you know, great singing actors. Sometimes they didn't have great voices, but you know what they did, you know, was on stage was profound. And so they wrote these fabulous long tunes, you know, where these dramatic singing actors could inject sort of drama and tragedy into the line, you know. So even if you're singing something, you know, really happy, you know, you know, the soprano, you still know that the soprano's got a dagger in her hand and she just sort of kill you, you know. But you know, that's what bel canto is. It means beautiful singing, but long line and injecting with you know, absolute passion.
So that the term can only be used for those operas that have are written by those composers.
That is
composers.
So. Okay. But, you know, it's like the word antique. You know, someone can show you, you know, a table setting from the 1950s and they say it's an antique, whereas actually it should be, you know, at least 100 years old. Yeah, but no, people say, you know, you must sing this bel canto, which just means sing it beautifully, you know.
Okay. Because in your book I noticed that you've got a very witty line, which I quite love, which is it goes from bel canto to cant belto and, you know, so on and so forth.
That's the ages of this voice.
Well, let's talk about the relationship between conductor and singer then.
Everyone is different. And look, we have lots of different types of conductors. I've seen conductors come in and not even look up on stage. They have absolutely no idea who is singing or what they're doing and they actually don't care. But I'm one of the sort of collaborative people. I want the audience to, you know, it's the audience that we're performing to for. And I want the audience to see the best of what the singer has. So it's my job to be like a channeler, you know, between the composer, i.e. the score, and what the director has done on stage and what the singer has to offer. So, I don't know, look, it's sort of like a mental, an ESP or whatever, what's the word, you know?
Telepathy. Sort of,
telepathic, you know, relationship that you have. And I've frequently taken over productions without any rehearsal whatsoever. And I don't get even 5 minutes with the singers. And I just go in, you know, beforehand, and I say, toy, you know, be great. And let's be fabulous out there. And, you know, we just do it. Like, I was in Tokyo in July. It was my first time there conducting La Sonnambula of Bellini. And I rehearsed for 4 weeks. And then on opening night, the soprano and the tenor, the star performers, flew in. And I met them at 7 o'clock for a 7 o'clock, 7:30 opening night. It was broadcast on Tokyo Radio, whatever it was. And all they said to me was, ciao maestro. That was it. It was Patrizio Cioffi and Antonio Siragusa. And they just... they flew, and I'd rehearse with other people. So that broadcast performance, when one hears it, we're just sort of feeling each other out for the first few minutes, and then we know what each other is going to do. And I had no idea what ornaments they were going to do, no, what cadenzas, no nothing. And you just know.
Right.
It's like, you know, sitting across the table from someone, and sometimes you just click and you know what they're doing. But I think performers have to have a bit of, well, have ESP or whatever it is. You should be able to read what someone is thinking. That's what great artists do. Well, artists do.
Right.
Okay. Just open out, you know, open that little door and you enter in. So I can tell if you're a bastard or not, or what you're thinking.
So what, how did you get to that point where you could do that? Did that just come naturally to you? That ability to read other people?
I think you just have to.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's survival, I suppose. Because if you're talking to someone, you have to have some sort of connection with them.
Mm.
And if you just talk at someone, well, then you're not going to listen to what they're saying in response. It's getting very deep. Too deep for me. But yeah, look, that's just what it is. You know? And look, I love singers.
Yep.
I love orchestras as well, you know. And I don't know. I just zhoosh them up to being fabulous.
So what, apart from that ability to sort of read into other people's minds, makes a good conductor?
A good conductor emanates confidence. whether they're a charlatan or not, whether they're really bad or really good, if you trust them, you'll give everything to them and you'll do it, you know, and then you'll give your best. That's what a good conductor is, someone you really trust. But a good opera conductor has that, plus they have a big personality and they have a sense of drama and theatre. You tell the story. You inject all the colours, you know, of yourself into that score to make the production exciting for an audience. You can have a really boring conductor who just sort of beats time and is sort of small and reserved, and that comes out in the score, in the reading, and then the orchestra sort of play that way as well. You know, I in my time have been really flamboyant on the podium, but I found after a lot of work how to get to the audience, the orchestra, and performers to be flamboyant and me be less so. So, right. You know, they're doing all the work whilst I just, you know, do it with small hair but huge energy rather than just looking like someone having an epileptic fit on the podium.
So say I was a person in the orchestra, what would you be doing to me in order to...
I'd be ignoring you, actually. But I don't know. I'd be giving, you know, that thought, whatever it is, you know. You just have to look at someone and they know how you want them to play.
Because I wonder whether, you know...
We've had sort of very famous conductors, you know, like Herbert von Karajan. Have you ever seen him on film, you know, conducting? He looks so he's just sort of standing there, sort of holding his hands sort of nicely and sort of shaking or moving them in nothing to do with rhythm, nothing. It's just an expression. And you think, how on earth can anyone follow that? But in actual fact, when you're in front of them, you know exactly what they're doing. You know, Richard Bonning, of all people, is exactly like that. You know, if you just watched him from behind, you would have no idea what he was doing. Yeah, but you know exactly what he's doing in front of him.
Okay.
Richard and I have the same birthday.
Oh.
Except he's slightly older than me.
I was going to say, yes. I've noticed that there's something else with conductors that they all kind of seem to have in common. It's the crazy hair. It's crazy hair, you know.
Some conductors have, you know, really sort of, you know, a number two or whatever it is. Yeah. You know? No, I don't know. I just have my hair like this because it's... Are you saying it's crazy?
No,
no. Is that
no,
what you're
no.
saying? No, and I did the ABC. Do you watch
the
ABC?
New logo, yeah.
That's me. You know, that guy who conducts those 3D coloured balls? Have you seen that?
Oh, yes, actually.
Yeah, that's me. Huh. You see, my hair was down for that. It was bobbed for that. You know, I wore these glasses too. But, yeah, I don't know. No. You know, I'm just a bit of a wank.
Tell me about that, actually, because...
About wank?
In opera world, there seems to be...
Are we not to say this on radio?
Oh, yeah, no, we can on this radio. Okay. It's a bit of a fun show, so yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so tell me about that. Like, in terms of the opera world, there is just... Status sometimes is a show in itself.
Status of whom?
The status of the person they try to portray, I suppose. So we're talking, you know, the audience, and then we're also talking about the sort of notion that opera is sort of on the high shelf. It's out of reach of the normal, everyday people.
It used to be like that.
Yeah.
But for for several decades, producers have tried to make it accessible. Which is what I do in my comparing. I, you know, make the aria accessible. And, you know, I love people who have never been to see an opera before. I love them to come and think, this is absolutely fantastic. I'll go to see another show, you know, that you've really won then. Or a young child, you know. And if I go out, you know, onto the podium and, you know, as I do my bow and there's a child sitting near me, I always sort of smile at them or something. And before I go off at interval, I'll say, you know, did you like that or not? Or, you know, what did you think of that? And, you know, I say, you know, because I love children, you know. I do play school as well.
Yes.
You know? Yes. So, look, opera should be accessible because, look, it's a great art form. It's like those sort of Roman gladiators, you know. The normal person, your next-door neighbour used to go to the Colosseum and see people, you know, killed. Well, that's the same thing with opera. You know, your next-door neighbour should be going to, you know, see Tosca jumping off that battlement.
Mm.
Because, you know, opera is a combination of all the greatest sort of forms of art.
Is there a right or a wrong way to enjoy opera?
No.
So if somebody was so taken, they should just applaud?
Yeah. And look, I must say, it's verboten in Australia and England, but I have booed if something was bad.
Right.
I think, you know, we should, you know, we're paying money. We should let the performers know how much we're enjoying it or if it's not good. Years ago, when I first went to work in Italy, I was doing Semiramide in Pesaro, but then on one of the off nights they did the Rossini Stabat Mater, and Marcello Giordani was singing Cuius Animam with a big D flat in it, and he sang it and cracked. And this was in the Pala Festival, which was like a 4,000-seat sort of basketball stadium, and the entire auditorium booed and sort of, you know, hissed and whatever. This is the middle of the performance. And so he just sort of held up his hand and he did the whole cadenza again and sang a shining D flat and they cheered.
Oh, wow.
Then they went on with the show.
Hmm.
You know, and that's great. And the first time my wife ever saw Norma, Bellini's opera, we were in Genova. And at the end, everyone came out for the curtain calls and the tenor came out and people ran down the aisle and threw their programs at him.
Right.
And they just kept booing. She was absolutely shocked. Look, you know, they still loved him, but they were saying, you know, you were shit tonight. You know, next time I see you, you know, you better be better. And, you know, this guy has, you know, Fabio Ammaliato, I could say. He has, you know, a big career. He accepts that, you know, I had a terrible night, but I'll be better next time.
Right.
But don't you like that sort of thing?
I do, and I think...
If you're watching Idol, which, by the look of you, you probably do watch that sort of...
I'm more of a So You Think You Can Dance kind of a boy, but anyway.
Yes, yeah, I can see that from your lycras that you're wearing. Yeah, but your audiences, if something, you know, if the judge says something negative, they boo. Which is stupid anyway, because, you know, what will they just know anyway, you know? Anyway, the reaction of an audience should be great.
Okay. So what you're saying is we should bring a touchdown screen into opera now and, you know, when...
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I did that Opportunity Oz performance.
Yep.
The applause at the end of the first scene that the bass did, the sort of winner bass, it's like Winnebago, doesn't it? The winner bass. There was, like, at least 5 minutes of this huge applause. And I actually wrote about this in the book. In that place in the opera, I've never heard any applause anyway. But it's because, you know, he was a sort of superstar in their eyes. Mm. And they were all there. These guys in the audience had never been, they'd never even driven past an opera house before, let alone be in it. And it went on like for 5 minutes. I couldn't believe it. It was like being at some rugby match, as if I'd ever been there at a rugby match. And when I came out for the second... after second interval, you know, and that's where the orchestra has their applause. When I came out, someone called out Spunk, you know, right. To the conductor. I was less fat then. But anyway, I digress.
Yes, you're speaking about a fantastic response from the audience.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable. And that night was sort of a special night. You know, I do know that some people who had been there for the first time ever actually came back to see other operas.
Mm.
Whether they liked them or not is another matter, but they actually came back for a second taste. You know, if you go to a restaurant for the first time, it's fabulous. You'll go back a second time.
Mm. And you'll bring friends as well.
Yeah. Mm. Or meet friends there and take them home with you, you know.
Well, that would certainly entice a lot of people to opera, I think.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the operas that you've worked on over the years. You've got, it's in the book as well, there's La Boheme, Madame Butterfly, Don Giovanni and Turandot.
Look, I've worked on hundreds of different operas and various productions of each, you know, of things. I've done Boheme, I don't know how many different productions. And because Opera Australia, which is my home base, they do it like every 2 or 3 years. Sometimes in interesting productions and sometimes in crap productions, you know, with people going to the toilet on stage, which I can't stand. Look, they're all masterpieces, and things like Boheme is such a great work that you could set it in a tin can and with really terrible singers, and it still appears to be a great opera because it's such a powerful work, a powerful story and fabulous score. But if you have it performed by absolutely fabulous singers, It's another language, you know. It's another level. I don't have any more to say about Boheme.
I think the Boheme that I saw recently, and the first one I've ever seen, was at Federation Square. It was on the big screen.
Yeah. With Antoinette, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was just a beautiful production. I cried in public, I think it was.
Yeah. Must have been one of the three people out there that night. Because Antoinette texted me and she said, there are only about 20 people there. She's so funny. I love Antoinette. She's a funny, very funny girl and sends very rude text messages. Now, that's the sort of thing I would tell an audience whilst introducing her. You know, and then she comes out and they sort of, you know, think, oh, this girl's, you know, one of us. Mm. And then she sings like a goddess and they think that's even better, you know?
Tell me about any stories that you have of great operatic disasters.
Which? Name an opera.
Madame Butterfly.
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 Well, I do know that in the late 1950s or early 60s in Australia, there was a touring, you know, the opera company here, whatever it used to be called in those days, did a touring version, and the woman who was singing Butterfly, Cho-Cho-San, when I first joined the opera company, part of being a repetiteur on music staff, you have to play auditions. And she must have been, I don't know, in her 60s. And she was wearing all brown, a brown twin set, and, you know, brown skirt and brown stockings, brown shoes and handbag, you know. I presume it was a handbag. Might have been a colostomy, for all I know. Everyone in the company from the old, you know, the old regime were looking through the window, looking at this woman. And of course, they knew her. I only knew her name. And they, you know, they said, what are you going to sing? I'd like to sing Un Bel Di. And she sang, holding this handbag, the loudest version of Un Bel Di I've ever heard in my life. It was fantastic, you know. No concept of, you know, what the aria was about. But it was the most glorious noise I've ever heard in my life. That was the end of the story. And she was singing Cho-Cho-San on tour with the opera company. And to go on for act two, the stage manager knocked on her dressing room and said, this is your 5-minute call or something. She wasn't there. She wasn't in the theatre at all. She'd gone down to the train station because she said that she wasn't singing well enough in act one. So she didn't want to go on with the show, but didn't tell anyone. She was sitting there with her bag at the train station waiting for the train to go. That's not exactly what you asked for, but that's the sort of person I really love.
Yeah.
Well, not that they sort of, you know, jump ship during a show. Mind you, she's still saying fantastically. Yeah, what else about Butterfly? I don't know, I'll be doing Butterfly at the moment down here in Melbourne. It's quite a nice looking production and a nice cast. The first Butterfly I did was an Andrew Sinclair production. It was in Bris Vegas. And it was quite beautiful. It was sort of a traditional thing with these little bridges, you know, from a distance, tiny ones, or big ones and coming tiny. You know, so it looked like the stage was really deep. And Cho-Cho-San made her entrance right from the very back of the theater, you know, the stage coming forward. It was really beautiful and the costumes were gorgeous and whatever. We had Jane Eaglin. Have you heard of Jane Eaglin?
I haven't, no. Tell me about Jane
Eaglin. It's very bad that you don't know Jane Eaglin. Jane is an English girl and she, in the late 80s, became quite prominent, singing major Wagner roles, and then she put on a lot of weight, and now she doesn't sing at all. She sang all the Brunhildes and Nottemers at the Met, and based in Seattle a lot, and I think she still lives in Seattle, but can't sing now anymore because she's just sort of obese, poor bitch. But Jane was singing Cho-Cho-San, and I say she looked like a lounge suite, you know, wearing this chintz. It was just shocking. And, you know, the costume was, the makeup was the traditional thing, sort of white face and, you know, little red lipsticks. And she looked as though she'd stuck her head in a flower bag and then, you know, put on these lips. And the voice was absolutely huge. And you know how there's a child in who comes out, whatever. She sang the cue for Suzuki to bring on the child, and he came and blah, blah, blah. And then he was supposed to embrace her, and she started singing, and all he could do was put his hands over his ears and go, ah! It's just absolutely appalling. Anyway, but that happened every time she sang in performance. You know, so the audience would go, they had to sort of suspend belief, I think. Yes. I think
there's a Met Opera production that we'll get to see on screen in March, and they've got the right idea. The boy is a puppet as opposed to an actual
Well, the
boy.
Oz Opera production this year, the child was a puppet.
Ah, right, okay.
Mm. Mm. In fact, in the book, I called him by his name is Dolore, which means sorrow, but a lot of productions, they call him Trouble.
Trouble.
Which of course he is, because he's a fucking child, you know. Can't stand them. I love children. But those ones are absolutely appalling. And, you know, opening night down here, that child, Jordan, I think his name is, or something, he had, his dressing room was absolutely filled with all these gifts and huge bouquets, more than the Church of San.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. And the director was telling me about this fabulous Italian who came out, must have been in the 60s, late 60s, to do Church of San. And then she was sort of a famous Church of San around the world, because sometimes if you're good at a role, you sing it all the time everywhere. And she was in Germany somewhere, and the child was, you know, apparently when she had to, you know, on cue, he had to embrace her and did everything absolutely right, you know. And then he really squeezed into a, you know, this gorgeous boy. But of course, it's one of those productions that you don't get rehearsals. You just go on and do it, you know, into a production that's been going for a while. And she thought, this boy is really good. I've never experienced, you know, someone, you know, a young child, you know, a five-year-old or something who was so stage-worthy. And apparently, after the show, you know, she left stage door and there's like a 45-year-old midget standing there sort of waving his keys at her. Anyway, she wondered why he'd be touching her breasts during the show. Yeah. It's a true story. But I love stories like that.
That's cool, yeah.
That's Butterfly.
That's Butterfly. What about Don Giovanni?
No, Mozart's boring.
We can move on to Turandot if you like.
Turandot's okay as well. Except when we first did that famous Turandot, Graham Murphy Turandot production, someone in the cast, I was prompting it, I remember. You know, the little guy who sits in the box at the front of the stage, which we don't have anymore with the opera company, because Simone Young thought that the singer should be looking at her rather than the prompter. Oh, I shouldn't mention who that was, so just... Everyone just forget the name I just mentioned, Simone Young. And, you know, I used to also, in beginning of Act 3, used to have to hold the black silk down, you know, with the sort of air going on. It was sort of like, whilst he sang Nessandora or whatever. But when the executioner came on, one of the, this will probably delight some of your listeners, when the executioner, you know, that sort of big muscle man person came on, someone in the cast recognized him from some sort of porno video at the time. And it's amazing, you know, where some of these people, you know, are also seen.
That's great.
I don't need to elaborate on that
one. I wish you would. Which website is that?
Actually, there are a couple of people connected with the porn industry who actually work in opera. It's quite true.
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. And... about 2 years ago, there was someone working in orchestral management at an opera company. I'm not going to say which one. And every time this person would just come out and ask me, you know, now, where do you want the clarinets, you know, are they going to be higher? And I thought, my God, you know, this person is speaking to me. It's like when I, you know, had to work with Deborah Byrne the first time, you know, all I could think of was, you know, her sex tape, you know. I thought, no. Anyway. That's the sort of thing that I like talking about.
I love it. It's
stories
great.
Of the operas are boring.
Yeah. Tell me, let's take a quick, let's change the direction for a second. Let's talk about Play School.
Play School?
Yes.
You're
the man who plays the piano at Play School.
And on screen too.
And on screen.
Yeah, children recognize me. Huh. As Brian. Mummy, there's Brian. People send me text messages to say, you're on screen, you know, blah, blah, yeah. blah, blah, blah. Because, you know, they just repeat them all the time, yeah. you know, which is great. And sometimes, you know, people you see on a broadcast, you know, they've been dead for 20 years, you know. Look, as I said, you know, I love children. I love people who come to the opera for the first time, you know, because I want to get them, you know, there for the next time. And when I'm playing on Play School, you know, it's all improvised.
Mm.
If someone's reading, you know, reading a story or something and I'm just sort of playing, you know, melodrama music in the background, usually whatever I've been working on comes out, the tune. So you get bits of Cenerentola or Butterfly or whatever, or Tosca, okay.
yep.
in those tunes. But sometimes I'm a bit sort of cryptic as well, because I like to make it sort of pertaining, you know, whatever that aria is about is pertaining to whatever. And there was an episode where Big Ted and Jemima were were in Egypt. And it was Pharaoh Ted and Queen Jemima. Well, I suppose, you know, you already sort of would have heard Queen Ted. And is that terrible? I'm going to be kicked out of the station any second. And
got my finger on the buzzer ready to...
on the beep. On the rehearsal, the head honcho, Virginia Thompson at ABC Children's Program, just stood around and she just sort of nodded. And, you know, it was one of those, you know, telepathic things, you know, Aida. So when we did the filming, there was bits of the ballet music of Aida, blah, blah, blah. And then as they were doing the grand procession, you know, away, you know, with all these sort of stupid tinsel shit. And I did the introduction to Ritorno Vincitor, and then they all started singing Walk Like an Egyptian, which, you know, I know sort of classical music, but I don't know Walk Like an Egyptian, so, you know, I had to. Anyway, but it fitted perfectly.
Yeah.
And there's Jay Laguerre and Karen Pang, it was, doing Walk Like an Egyptian. Fitted perfectly with Verdi.
Oh, that's very clever.
Yeah, so, you know, when a child comes to see Aida next year, they'll say, I had that on PlayStation first. Gee, that man stole it from ABC children's programming.
That's very clever. No, I like that. That's something.
Oh, you had to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's another guy who does most of the programs because I'm not available. And, you know, he plays what he knows as well. So, you know, which isn't sort of too classical, and, you know, he's brilliant. And, you know, colours all those, you know, the readings and things. He's fantastic. But I sort of do opera versions of things, which is sort of cute.
Yeah.
Make it boppy, you know.
Boppy versions of opera.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you feel about things like the El Divo and all that sort of stuff, who, you know, sort of popularize and do opera pop, popera?
Oh, I think they've destroyed the art form.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hate them, you know, although I do like David Miller, you know, from Il Divo. He came out to Sydney and sang Pearlfishers, first time I did it there. But, yeah, I think it has sort of, and that hideous André Rieu, you know, I'm not ashamed to, you know, say that. You know, that's just terrible. All those old ladies think he's great. But it's lessened the art form. As has Idol for pop music. And so you think you can dance for that art form. Just going back to your comment.
Well, I have no... Yeah. All right. So let's talk about opera again. My mind is scattered today. I don't know why.
It's the weather.
And I think it's heating up in here as well.
I should put my clothes back on. Should we say that the book is called Losing the Plot in Opera? And there's a website.
And I've lost the plot already, so that's...
There's a website called losingtheplotinopera.com.
Yeah.
And I do encourage people to write in and say, tell any experiences they have of, of attending opera or how much they like it or how much they hate it, whatever. And I did write about... because, you know, opera is made up of lots of things. There are singers, there's orchestra, but there's all these people backstage, you know, people who, you know, do all the sets and, you know, move sets and sweep the stage and the makeup guys and the wig guys. And I did say, I asked one of the wig guys what he does after a show, because at the end of the show, people come at like 10:30 or 11 and they take the wig off and there's sort of glue on the wig that holds it onto your side of the face. So they have to get all that off. So they have to sort of clean the wig and prepare it for the next performance. So they finish very late. And I said, what do you do? You know, do you go home and just watch television? He said, oh, no, I just go into chat rooms.
I think we might wrap it up. And I've enjoyed this immensely. This has been great. Thank you. So because this is an opera show for beginners, what would you recommend as a good opera for a beginner to go to?
I think something with a fabulous score and a fabulous sweeping story. I think Rigoletto was a great, great work. Or any of those Verdi things, you know? I personally hate comic operas because, you know, comedy is the hardest form of theatre to play. Was Ed Wynn, when he was dying, you know, they said, he said, dying's easy, comedy's hard. Then he died. It was a quite true story. Ed Wynn, famous actor. But I hate seeing opera singers trying to be funny on stage. Because it ain't funny. It makes me sort of, you know, throw up in the back of my mouth. And whenever I'm conducting something like Barbara Sill or something, I am so strict with them, you know, not to be silly on stage or this sort of crap, you know. Let the story be funny and just sing fantastically. So, look, I think something like those Verdi or Puccini things, you know, Turandot's a fabulous thing to see. It has no story, but it's fabulous.
Thanks very much, Brian.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9 Community Radio. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.